Anyway, so I think within a very short time, it seems I'll be going back to the Mahabharata, Pandu's book. And I wanted to. This book I just did was really. It was also an exercise to learn how to write, because it just like Michael Jordan. This is his name, right? Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
He was a great basketball player, and then he thought, "Hey, I'm a great athlete. I can do baseball too," but actually couldn't do baseball very well. I mean, he was all right, but so it's an interesting example. I thought it was very instructive because here he is, generally considered the best basketball player, but in baseball he was somewhat mediocre. So, and as a coach, but apart from that. So, I've written books, or I've published books, nonfiction, in Bhagavatam, or published other articles, but novels are a completely different genre. It's like basketball and baseball. You may be able to do one, but not the other. So, I actually took some time to, practice, try to learn how to do it. So that, it seems I came out well, at least by the objective, well, anyone that praises my book is objective. Anyone that doesn't like it is obviously very subjective. So, that's a great thing about being a guru. You can always feel good about what you do. So, but anyway, I wanted to try to learn the art of novel writing so that I could present the Mahabharata in a way that would really, that would finally fulfill the purpose of the ask. Mahabharata was meant to be for the people in general, the povam. It was meant to be for the people in general, and it really has not made it. It has not been a success outside a Hindu context. And, of course, there's another little niche of people who have some connection with or sympathy for Hinduism, like Hare Krishna devotees or New Age people. So there's a certain market, which in the West is tiny. And, of course, India, that's it. And there have been dozens and dozens and dozens of Mahabharatas, and it's never really moved significantly beyond this limited market. In fact, just a few days ago, I was with Krishna Dharma in England, who did a very nice presentation on Mahabharata and also Ramayana. And he told me that actually it hasn't sold. I mean, it sold some copies in the thousands. It's certainly not a failure, but nothing. It hasn't really at all broken into a mainstream market. So anyway, that's the idea. Try to present the Mahabharata in a very different way. Not, of course, changing the basic facts of the story, but to present it in a very different way.
Can you describe how you differ from Krishnadama's approach?
Yes. Oh, you're from the UK?
Yeah, I edited half his books.
So. Oh, what's your name?
Kalyapani.
Kalyapani. Well, I don't want to present this. I mean, I don't want to say I'm going to do something. I don't want to criticize Krishna Dharma, because I think he did a very nice service. He's a very good devotee. But I think that the story, the way it comes to us is has two flaws, actually, or several flaws in it. First flaw, as pointed out emphatically by Madhvacharya, the great Madhvacharya, is that the Sanskrit text that we now have of the Mahabharata is a very corrupt text. Madhvacharya says that if you read the unabridged version, it becomes very apparent. So, for various reasons. Then, even if we talk about an original, uncorrupted text, we find in the Bhagavatam that when Vyas was despondent, that Narada told him, you really sort of ruining that. He used stronger language than that. If you look at the language in the Bhagavatam, the first thing Narada says when talking about that is jugupsitam, which in Sanskrit means abominable, terrible, disaster. He said jugupsitam dharma kritis, that for the sake of dharma, there's been a mahan vyatikrama, literally a great transgression, something which is terrible. Very, very, very strong language. So, just to give one simple example, in the Mahabharata that we now have, none of the characters really, I don't think any of the characters I know, have any interest whatsoever in going to a spiritual world. It's like the rage is Indraloka. Everybody wants to go to Indraloka. So you have this, thank you. Can I see a menu also?
We have a few things without alcohol.
Really? Do you have like a vegetarian entree?
A couple of options.
A couple of options, okay. Oh my God, it's filming. I was just busted.
Send to chakra.
VNN is over. No more VNN.
A couple of jogo. So, so there's this tremendous inconsistency between the Gita and the Mahabharata in some ways. And
sorry for that. Be quiet.
Oh yeah, cell phones. Anyone has a cell phone? Could you please
turn it off?
Yeah, turn it off. Or you can donate to me and I'll try to sell it.
eBay. So on eBay.
eBay, right. I'm a major trader on eBay with all the gifts I get from preaching. So, anyway, so you have a text which originally was somewhat misleading and then it's been corrupted, seriously corrupted. And then there's another issue also, and that is that, I should mention that it's not that we're completely lost at sea, because we have the Bhagavatam, which gives the basic story of Mahabharata. The Lord Chaitanya appreciated the Bhagavatam, so we know basically what happened. We know the basic story. So, another problem is that the Mahabharata is a particular genre. Swami Gita. The Mahabharata is a particular genre which technically we call epic narrative. It's similar in style to the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, or even things like Gilgamesh, other epic narratives. And so the nature of epic narrative as a type of literature is that the characters tend to be presented in a somewhat stereotypical way, in the sense that the characters embody and represent and display certain basic virtues and vices, so it's almost like a morality. It's almost like a battle between virtues and vices. So that, I don't mean to say the Pandavas were actually like that, but the presentation is sort of like Yudhisthira's almost always indecisive, Bhima is almost always angry. You know, so you see, and Duryodhana is almost always engaged in some sneaky, dirty trick. So everyone is just always doing it. And as it, I mean, that, and what makes it worse is that, in a sense, well, on the one hand, the Mahabharata has these somewhat stereotypical, predictable character developments, and then, to make it worse, the characters reverse. So you end up with no story. No, you don't even end up with a stereotypical story, you end up with no story. For example, the battle between Karna and Arjuna, suddenly Karna becomes every mother's son. And everyone feels sorry for Karna, and Arjuna is sort of, you know, using dirty tricks. And the battle between Bhima and Duryodhana, Bhima strikes a low blow, so then you start, you know, in fact, you have sympathy for Duryodhana, who ends up in heaven anyway, despite life of evil. And you have this great character, Drishtadyumna, the brother of Draupadi, who unfairly kills Drona. And it's, it's, like, you think, if you ever see a movie like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, and if you ask a simple question, like, what's driving this story? Why is it that people like the story? What is it that engages them emotionally in the story? You have to have a story. There has to be a clear battle between good and evil. And, of course, people like some, you don't want just like, well, sometimes people do want a comic book story, like Spider-Man, but I mean, you have to do some nuances, complexity, like the good people have problems, the bad people have some qualities that you can appreciate. Like, did you see Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Like, for example, even that guy, the Joker.
Green
Goblin?
Yeah. Well, the guy that flies around. That
yeah, Green Goblin.
Green Goblin.
What?
Green Goblin.
Who's, you know, he's this rich industrialist, and he and his son is friends with.
Awesome.
So you see that he kind of cares about his son. So it's like a little human touch. Or Peter Parker has these problems. He's kind of this self-conscious nerd. And so you have heroes and villains who both have human touches. So that's all right. Even though Peter Parker made a mistake, like he didn't stop the criminal that killed his uncle. So that was a mistake. But the mistake wasn't so severe that you lose him as a hero. In other words, you realize it was a mistake, but then he does that, and I mean, it's a question of the art of narration. Now imagine, has anyone else here seen the Spider-Man?
Yes.
I know, it's a Vaishnava movie. So, so when Peter Parker sees that his uncle has been killed, and he kind of realizes, he reacts in a very powerful way. He immediately just goes nuts, and he goes after this person. And actually, if you analyze the psychology of it, when he corners this criminal and starts, you know, punching him and everything, it's really kind of like, how should I put it? He's sort of like making up for what he did wrong, and really very strongly gaining the sympathy of the viewers. And then when you see him lamenting, grieving over what he did, he's fully restored to the status of a hero. But now he's a hero that has a real human side and that has some pain in his heart and so on. So you can actually analyze these things. But now take Yudhisthira, for example, who gambles away Draupadi. Yudhisthira gambles away Draupadi, which is really, and fortunately that's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam, so it's, from my point of view, it's not something that I have to present in my book, because it's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam. In fact, the Bhagavatam three times mentions the insult to Draupadi in the gambling hall. It's mentioned three times in different places in the Bhagavatam. And each time the Bhagavatam says precisely the same thing, that the offense against Draupadi was that they grabbed her hair. And so, anyway, it gets into the whole issue of trying to figure out what really happens. But Lord Chaitanya did not say that the Mahabharata had all the correct philosophical conclusions that the Bhagavatam did. But in any case, to gamble away a wife in a situation where if you lose your wife, which he did, that the wife can then can be exploited, sexually exploited by, hundreds of men. And to gamble away your wife like this is so far over the line that in terms of, I think for a modern reader, Yudhisthira really becomes defunct as a hero. I mean, he's really lost. I don't mean the real Yudhisthira, who's a great personality. But from a literary point of view, he's kind of like, he's out. It's like a soccer game. One of the players is injured, has to be carried off the field. I mean, he's just out of the game. And throughout the rest of the Mahabharata, he never makes it up to Draupadi. In fact, when they're incognito in the Virat kingdom, and this really obnoxious chauvinist, this Kichika, is harassing Draupadi, Yudhisthira doesn't know anything about it. Bhima has to do something. So again, you think of Peter Parker, in a sense, inadvertently causing the death of his uncle. I mean, not the direct cause, but indirectly contributing. I mean, but significantly contributing to the death of the one person, in a sense, that he cares the most about. And then that's why he has to go after the criminal. That's why he has to grieve, because he needs to be restored to the status of a hero that you can really identify with and that you can be sympathetic to. But in the case of Yudhisthira, nothing like that happens. And so if you just... And then Bhima gets knocked out. So if you analyze the story in terms of how you... It just doesn't work for modern readers. It just, I believe the reason it doesn't work is because if we take Sripad Madhvacharya seriously, I think over time, and then there are different editions of the Mahabharata, if you look at the whole manuscript tradition of the Mahabharata in different regions of India, that it's been so Hinduized, it's been so Indianized, it's been so customized according to Hindu sensibilities and preferences, that it just doesn't really work for people outside the context. So, I mean, the last final thing, like Arjuna's battle with Karna, it's like a political campaign where your opponent comes out with some really horrible accusation the day before the election. You don't have time to recover. You haven't got time to counteract it. So, the last dramatic thing we see of Arjuna is killing Karna. And the way the story's been told, everyone cry, poor Karna. So that's like almost like the last taste you have of Arjuna. Then, of course, the battle's over, he does this and that, and he goes out again and make sure everybody accepts Yudhisthira's authority and stuff like that. But that's really... I mean, there are other interesting things with Arjuna, but... So, I think it's possible to analyze logically, reasonably, why it is the Mahabharata, for various reasons, has not really attracted a world audience, even though that was the intention of the author. And then to give another example, something which I think totally doesn't work, or which really makes the story just inert, emotionally inert for modern readers. And that is that it's like, whether it's Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, all those great epic stories always end with a monumental battle, good versus evil. Isn't it? I mean, that's just the way you do it. And so the Mahabharata, everything is cruising, everything is leading up toward this final battle of Kurukshetra. But in many different ways, the Hindu version of the text totally deflates the story. It's like, I mean, the art of narration, it very basically means that in order to tell a good story, you have to create tension. And of course, you have to create tension for the reader or the viewer. But to create tension in the reader has to care about the people in the story. Because if the reader doesn't care about the people, then it's like, who cares what happens to these people? I don't care if this guy ends up marrying this girl. I don't care if this guy ends up escaping from these evil people. I don't care if, you know, you just, like, who cares? I don't care about these people. But if you can successfully get the reader to care about the people, then you create dramatic tension, and then it builds up to a pitch, and then it's resolved. So, obviously, the climax, in a sense, of the Mahabharata story is the Battle of Kurukshetra. And then things happen after that, but really that's the climax. And in many ways, the Hindu version totally deflates it. It's like a balloon that you prick. So all the dramatic tension just, rather than building up and resolving, it just collapses. Because in various ways it becomes clear that the battle doesn't matter. It really doesn't even matter what side you fight on. So imagine Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, where who cares? It's trivial which side you fight on. So for example, I'll give you a few examples of what I mean by this. You get Bhishma and Drona, who are so respectable. They're so respectable. And they fight on the wrong side, but they're, you know, and no one really says anything about them. In the Mahabharata, actually, Bhima complains about it, but it's like, they're still completely respectable. It's like, no problem. Or, you're very sympathetic to Karna, and he's on the wrong side. And then Shalya, who's the uncle of the twins, Nakula and Sahadeva, and in a sense the uncle of all the Pandavas, he's on his way to help the Pandavas, but then in this, I think, very amazing story, Duryodhana, who's a famous king, known all over the world, is able to disguise himself and sort of hide behind bushes or whatever he does, and just kind of travel along with Shalya as he's on his way to the Pandavas' camp, and no one sees him, which is like, really makes you wonder. And he's going along for days, so close to Shalya, that as soon as Shalya says something, he'll hear it. And what he wants Shalya to say is, because what he does is, as Shalya's traveling, Duryodhana arranges all these little sort of like turnpike service areas, where Shalya can stop his army, you know, and get lemonade and a place to rest, and I don't know, pizzas, whatever. But all these little turnpike service areas, service plazas. And so finally Shalya says, oh man, I'm so grateful. Whoever built all these little service plazas, I'll give them anything. So, I mean, how did Duryodhana know that he's going to say that? I mean, imagine you go to all this trouble in a totally, literally unbelievable move. A world famous king is able to go undetected as he's literally this far away, close enough to hear what Shalya says. He's this far away for days, because who knows when Shalya's going to say it. So he's this far away from Shalya for days, and then no one notices he's there. And then Shalya says what Duryodhana hoped he would say, and as soon as he says, I'll do anything for whoever arranged these turnpike plaza, service plaza, immediately Duryodhana pops up and says, hi, I'm Duryodhana, and I'd like to cash in that offer you just made, and so I want you to fight on my side. And Shalya says, oops, I guess you got me. And so it doesn't matter. It's just sort of like, it really doesn't matter. After all, we're Kshatriyas. We can fight for this side or that side. Who cares? Yes.
The corruption of the Mahabharata, is this just something that happened over time?
Well, first of all, I want to finish this point. Yeah, I want to. So, do you want to talk about this, Brother Jordan?
Yeah, well, but you take something like Bhishma fighting on the other side.
Yeah.
I mean, you have like both sides wanted Robert E. Lee to be their general, and he chose one side. It's still considered by both sides kind of heroic, though, after all is said and done, you know, on the wrong side, at least the losing side.
Yes, however, the Civil War is has not. There's never been a really great movie made of the Civil War that had the same effect as Star Wars or Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And it's mostly seen as a tragedy, although now they do reenactments and everything.
It's not so black and white. Yeah.
It isn't. It's also, in that sense, not a great story. I mean, it was a powerful historical event. But Bhishma, in other words, if Bhishma, if it's not important which side he fights on, then the battle is just not that important.
But I mean,
people in other parts of the world are not fascinated necessarily by the Civil War. They've heard about it, everyone knows about it, but it's not like that. It fascinates people in other countries. It's important here because it's our history, it's our history as Americans. And the Civil War battlefields, but it's not something that just really fascinates people.
But then there's this Kshatriya code, just like a lawyer may argue the wrong side, but he's obligated to similarly.
And that's why people despise lawyers.
Yeah.
And actually, they're not obligated. If you feel that something is really morally wrong and you argue for it, I think the reason they put that code in is just so they can not lose any deals. To make as much money as possible. And that's why people hate lawyers. There's so many lawyer jokes. The point is, to me it would be a nonsense code, if the Kshatriya code is that for honor's sake, I fight for evil. How can it be that for the sake of honor, one fights for evil? If Robert E. Lee fought for the South, then he might have actually had some moral ambivalence about it.
Yeah, well, of course, I guess the final answer is that it's the politician's duty to decide what is evil and good, and it's the soldier's duty to do the fighting. No,
that's not at all true. In fact, in the military, you're told that you received an order, which is, really outrageous. You're not required to follow it. And that was not Bhishma's. But what kind of? I mean, first of all, that's anachronistic. That's American culture, where the modern democratic culture, the politicians decide and the soldiers fight. But if you were asked to fight for evil and you're a soldier, it's just not. Then you can't be a hero. It's like in say Star Wars, you see those like the trooper, what do they call them, the shock troops or the stormtroopers of the Empire. They're not heroes. No one cares about them. They're just kind of like they're just cannon fodder. They're just there to go down. I mean, no one cares about them that much. You have no emotional connection to them. They're just soldiers, just blindly following orders. Now, it is possible to create poignancy for Bhishma and all that. But just to be totally indifferent, it's like, if there's no problem that Bhishma fights for the wrong side, that's not a problem, then the battle's not that important. It just doesn't matter that much.
But I think, it was a problem that he fought for the wrong side.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean.
But in the Hindu version of it, it's kind of not. He's just like.
Doesn't even the Bhagavatam say he did fight on that side.
Yes.
So he did
And Prabhupada said that he and Drona lost their respectability as elders because they didn't defend Draupadi and so on. But what I'm saying is, if it's not a battle of good versus evil, if it doesn't matter that much what side you fight on, there's no story. I'm just saying dramatically, if it doesn't matter that much which side you fight on, if Bhishma doesn't care, and no one cares, the reader doesn't care either. It just doesn't. And that's why, if you think about the level of emotional intensity that's built up in Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, by the time the battle starts, you know, people are really emotionally excited about it. It doesn't happen in Mahabharata. It's just like this polite thing among Kshatriyas, and it doesn't matter what side you're on, and it's all a joke. It's all just sort of like this cute little polite thing. There's no story.
But if you follow this type of analysis, do you think you would also find discrepancies in the Bhagavatam?
No. No, I don't think so. I don't know of any. The Bhagavatam actually is a little more, I mean, or a lot more, just presents things more realistically. Like in the case of Shalya, it's, like it just doesn't matter to him. It's not a big deal to fight for evil, to fight for the wrong side, to fight, it's just not that important. And so the message the reader gets is this battle's not that important. It really doesn't matter which side wins. And frankly, I think, in my mind, my humble opinion, there's a relationship between the fact that in South Asia and India at the present times, there is an extraordinary amount of lying and cheating. I mean, isn't that kind of like mainstream? And that culture in which there's a tremendous amount of lying and cheating has presented a picture of Krishna in which he's always lying and cheating.
Well, he's not flirting.
Well, no, but I mean, just in terms of... No, actually...
That's how he presented.
No, but actually, when Krishna left Vrindavan, he wasn't flirting. In other words, the Vrindavan pastimes, it's like this magical, enchanted atmosphere, which Krishna's a young boy. He left Vrindavan, he's 12 years old. Like these very innocent, enchanting pastimes. Once Krishna left Vrindavan and really began to act out in the world as an adult, he didn't flirt. And he was actually very serious about his duty. That's the example he set. And I don't think he lied and cheated nearly as much as you think if you hear the Hindu version. No? In fact, it's like Narada Muni is always presented as a clown in Hindu movies. Isn't it? But he's never presented that way in the Bhagavatam. I will actually think about
his son's calling.
So if, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, if you listen to the voice of the Gita, it's a very powerful, straightforward, moral voice. It's not this cute little trickster. And so, you know, it's sort of like this Hindu conception where Narada's a clown and Krishna's always a cute little cheater. Not in his Mathura and Dwarka pastimes, he's not like that. He's actually very serious about those kinds of duties. So again, answering your question, what was your name again?
Kalyapani,
yes. I think there's all kinds of things that need to be presented in a somewhat different way. There's all kinds of inconsistencies. For example, I've given this example so many times, Arjuna's anger against Jayadratha after Abhimanyu was killed. Why? I mean, it's understandable that Arjuna was mad at Jayadratha, but why only Jayadratha? What about the people that actually killed Abhimanyu? I mean, does Arjuna feel any anger toward them? Not in the Mahabharata. The text we have, he actually feels no anger whatsoever for the people that actually physically killed his son. It's only about Jayadratha. It's not coherent.
We'd like to serve some prasadam.
Yeah, sure. So that's, I mean, answer to your question, I think, it has to be, again, I'm working within the boundaries of the Bhagavatam. So I have some boundaries, and that is the Bhagavatam. So I don't think I can say anything or write anything, but I think it has to be seriously adjusted to make it really work.
Like in theater, I've always thought of doing a series of if the characters were right, once the kind of conclusion of the story was right, it would be a lot more encouraging to work with it.
Yes. Otherwise, it can only be like Peter Brook, that was probably, supposed to give an award for the worst casting probably in the history of Western theater. But in any case, if you look at that presentation, it kind of attracted, predictably, the culture elites. You know, he went to very big cities and kind of like sophisticated people came to see it. And that's funny because Mahabharata was actually intended not just for the sophisticated people, it was meant to be the great epic of our time. It was meant to occupy the cultural space that is now held by works like Lord of the Rings. Well, of course, for the Christians, the Bible. But for people that aren't Christians, things like Lord of the Rings, I mean, it occupies a certain cultural space. And the Bhagavatam is meant to be there. I mean, sorry, the Mahabharata. The story of Krishna and the Pandavas. It's just not, I just find it not satisfying. Like, for example, the story Mahabharata, Karna. Karna's self-mutilation, when Indra comes disguised as Brahman and asks to ask Karna to give him his inborn or ingrown armor. And Karna never vowed to give anything to someone disguised as a Brahman. Just to a Brahman. And he was told by Vivaswami that this person's not really a Brahman, so the whole story, who knows what really happened, the whole story where he mutilates himself because someone disguises a Brahman, he's so honorable. I mean, why is it honorable to do something that you never said you would do? If it's going to cause all kinds of trouble to your friends. And why are those people your friends in the first place? I mean, the whole thing is just problem. Rajendra, you want to pursue your point?
I guess what you're saying is that the they think Bhishma. You're saying, well, he did go on the wrong side, but he's portrayed, but the fact that he's on the wrong side was kind of, in the Hindu version, is just kind of, so what? But it's actually significant.
Yeah.
Again, I see that. I see that.
And Drona was a Brahmin. Why is he even fighting?
Yeah.
Or, for example, this somewhat absurd story that Drona approached Drupada for charity and Drupada just, offended him.
Yeah. What's absurd about that one?
Well, there are different versions. There are different, okay. Mahabharata, there are different versions and different manuscript traditions. One of them even says that Drona, of course, married Kupi, who sometimes people unfortunately pronounce Kupi. Like Kripa, Kripi. So, and then they couldn't even afford milk for their darling little child, Ashwatthama, the future murderer. So, then why? The point is that Drona had married into the richest family in the world. He was a member of the richest family in the world. He married Kripi, who was the foster daughter of Shantanu, who had been the emperor. So Drona was part of the Kuru family. And when he was apparently rebuffed by Drupada, he went back to Hastinapur and was immediately posted as the principal of the military college. In other words, he was immediately given a beautiful place to stay, he was given all facility, so why didn't he go there first?
Yeah.
If you read the Vedas, there's an ancient rivalry between the Kurus and the Panchalas. It was very much like the history of England and France before World War I. And so Drona went to his Drupada was a great friend of Pandu, who was a pure devotee. Drupada supported Krishna. He fought for the Pandavas. That's another example with Shali, with Drupada, all these people, it just adds up to this complete ambiguity about what's right and wrong, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy. It's just not clear.
Sounds like modern India.
That's what it is.
Yeah, where there's morals and ethics and everything becomes very relative.
Yes, and that's what they've done to the text. And that's why it doesn't work dramatically. I take the case where Krishna tells Yudhisthira to lie. First, we have Krishna, this great hero, tricking Drona, and then killing an innocent elephant, and then Krishna telling someone to lie. It's just not.
Well, isn't that one in the Bhagavatam, though?
No, not at all. Someone gave me some, I forget where, when I got back from Atlanta.
Tomorrow's
a
codicil.
What?
Tomorrow's
a codicil.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Who's cooking for a codicil tomorrow?
Krishna Prastaya.
What?
Krishna Prastaya.
Krishna Prastaya?
Prastaya, yeah.
Oh, my God. She's making breakfast?
Lunch.
Maybe I should stuff myself now at this tomorrow's codicil.
It's lots of banana cake.
What?
Have a delicious banana cake.
Let me try it. Oh my God, that's serious. One of the cars. Is anyone here an expert ecodicy cook?
Expert
ecodicy cook?
There's fig Newtons in the fridge. If you want.
But tomorrow's ecodicy.
I mean, yeah, now.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Some tea.
What do we have for breakfast tomorrow? Do you want to make potatoes?
Yeah, we can. A good one I learned in Russia is this with this with the buckwheat grains, not the flour. It looks like small nuts, and you boil with a little water, and olive oil, and cucumbers, tomatoes, olives. It's delicious.
What about hash brown potatoes?
Yes, that's really good.
You know how to make that?
Yeah.
Oh, good, I'm safe. I have one.
Well, what's going to be your schedule for classes?
What's going to be my schedule?
Well, right now, Wednesday and Thursday morning, I think you said.
And Saturday.
Also,
Saturday's in.
Saturday's
Gorpurnima. Oh, Saturday's Gorpurnima, of course. Oh, by the way, one word of pronunciation, it's not Purnim, it's actually Purnima. devotees get, there are three vowels in the word, and devotees get all three of them wrong, which is admirable. It's actually long, short, long, like da, 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 pur, nima. That's just what it is. So, anyways, good luck. Anyway, good. Who made it? Urukmi?
Vishnu Shakti.
Oh, very good.
She's Vishnu, the husband is also Vishnu.
Wow.
She's Vishnu Shakti.
Yeah, she's a Shakti.
Would you like some more?
What else we got? I should say menu.
I just sort of started wondering about the corruption of the Bhagavatam. Is this something that was done?
Well, the Bhagavatam is very different.
Excuse me, the Mahabharata.
Yes.
Is this something was done deliberately or just happened?
It's an oral tradition for probably thousands of years. It was an oral tradition.
Did anybody have any ill motivation in causing it?
Well, for example, let's say someone's reciting the text as a living. That's how they maintain themselves in a family. And let's say if you, in your kingdom, a new king comes in and he's a Shaiva, devotee or Shiva. And so you're only allowed to recite in that kingdom if you start coming up with chapters, glorifying Shiva. Or to give another example, in the North Indian version of the Mahabharata, Parashara Muni met Satyavati on a boat, and Satyavati on a boat, and then they had a child, Vyasa. In South India, which is kind of like the Veda belt, like the Bible belt, the deep south of India, it was scandalous. You couldn't publicly say that an incarnation of God, Vyas, was born out of wedlock. So in the South Indian Mahabharata, there's a big wedding. And they get married. Satyavati and Parashara get married before Vyas is born. So there's all kinds of factors. Or, for example, let's say you're reciting one particular story people really like. To embellish it, and develop it more. That's what they want to hear.
It sounds like it's something that happened, not necessarily that somebody was deliberately trying to sabotage it.
Not sabotage, but just trying to just doing what they thought they had to do. And if things aren't written down, they're very unstable. It's not written. No one's going to say, wait a second, you just said this, but it says here. There's nothing written. Mahabharata had a long career, orally. And the goal is just try to spread Krishna consciousness.
And I'm glad the Bhagavatam is safe.
Oh, yeah. And the Gita.
Earlier you said you just came back from England and from some GBC meetings. I met the devotees like a couple of months ago, so everything that I know about ISKCON and the GBCs and what people say and some things that I read from Prabhupada books, what he would call ISKCON. So I would like to have an idea, just an insight, what's the plan for that, what the GBC, what's the GBC or ISKCON has for the whole movement, like in general right now. I'm just curious.
Wait, no.
And I know things that I heard things like from today or things that happened in the past, the whole story of ISKCON, but I'm curious about now. What he's
now?
Done now, yeah.
Well, there are many very good devotees in the GDC, and many of them are successful in their own areas. But this is the point I was discussing at the meeting. I think we're coming to the point where we need some leaders to focus as their main service or even full time on international issues, trying to lead. Because the way Prabhupada set it up, 11 and a half months a year, each GBC person is in their own zone for concern of their own work. And then, literally, for 2 weeks a year, you sort of meet and suddenly you're a world leader. So if you spend over 11 months a year being a regional leader, only a week or two being a world leader, it's just very difficult to. Yeah, and that's the system here. So we begin to see the need. We have over 500 branches, almost 100 countries. So there's a need to empower certain people to do as their primary service. And to think about the world.
And manage the global organization, because it is a global organization.
Well, some management is international, like, what you say, trying to get educational standards or just quality control. Probably wanted local autonomy. He didn't want a big bureaucracy. So, because Prabhupada was so anxious not to have a big bureaucracy, that has sort of inhibited any possible centralization, greater centralization. But now we're seeing that we have to certainly honor Prabhupada's, the spirit of Prabhupada's request and his intention. At the same time, there is a need to allow people, empower people to, as their primary service, to think about the world. Which is not the case now.
They have a GBC executive committee,
but they also have their own zones. They have full time service elsewhere. And then it changes, you know, the one person's chairman and someone else, so it's, there's need for more, I think, to refine the system. I'm going to wash my hands.
Thank you.
Sure.
Se vê bem.
Yes.
Isma é o verdadeiro herói do
Mahabharata.
Isma?
Yes. Para mim, ele é o herói do Mahabharata. Isma. Em que sentido?
Eu penso que ele é grande.
Ele é grande.
Mas
ele é o herói. If Bhishma is the hero of the Mahabharata, then the battle of Kurukshetra is maybe the Pandavas weren't really doing the right thing in fighting.
I want to cook something for you now.
Yeah, for tomorrow?
No. For
tomorrow. Oh, no.
Are you sure? This is good. It's light.
Oh, no.
Not too much, and it's good.
No. It's very, very kind of you. It's very nice of you, but thank you very much.
Ah, sabia que você me ama. Nossa. Eu até pensei.
Não,
que
eu não.
Ninguém mais me ama. Você pode pegar papel e limpar? Por favor, limpa.
I went there
in
1990.
So, what are you doing these days?
Okay.
So what are you studying now?
Well, my major right now is
English. At what school? Santa Fe. Oh, English.
I was thinking
of going in that
direction for a while. After you made that
comment. Oh, but I mean, some lawyers are good. I was just really talking about the notion that that a lawyer can just defend anyone, even if you know the person's wrong.
Well, didn't
one
also say lawyers are liars?
I mean, I think a lot of people say that. I mean, there are good lawyers. There are people who do good work in the world. Where's the Majerta? Where's the Majerta? Yeah, there are.
I didn't hear all these comments, but.
No, I mean, there are lawyers who do very good work in the world, or good people. It's just there's some that aren't. But if that's what you'd like to do, I mean, you could. I think you could be a good person and do the work.
Well, I think the movement. I mean, I don't know.
You're
saying you can't
work that,
but I would like to sort of movement somehow.
That's a great. I'm really delighted you feel that way. So, you shouldn't be discouraged if that's what you like to do. I just made your comment. I was really just responding to one specific point, and that is that certain lawyers, not all of them, say that I should take any case even if I know someone. In other words, if you know someone actually committed a crime, then you try hard to get them off to. But to me, that's just evil. Because the real point, it's not that everyone deserves to be defended. The real point is that justice should be defended. The reason that we say everyone should be defended is so that justice will be done. The goal is not just universal defense, the goal is justice. And you know that someone has done something wrong, then, I mean, how in the world can you try to exonerate a person that you know is guilty? To me, that's just nonsense. That's all I meant. And as far as all the lawyer jokes, some of them are pretty good. But yeah, but don't be discouraged if that's what you want to do. Because there's lawyers that also do great service, like Narendra. He's done so much great service for ISKCON, and they're lawyers that even maturely have fought for all kinds of things, like civil rights and justice. But there are some very good, honest people that come along.
I had a small question about the Mahard.
Yes.
When you're reading the original text, does it talk about the emotional personality about the characters? Like, does it get into that?
To some extent. But it's that type of epic narrative. To some extent.
Sometimes you see that it's like contradictory incidents, like in different Mahabharatas that read like you're talking about. Sometimes they appear that it doesn't matter, like, you know, which side they're on, and other times they feel really emotional, like once they give their word about something.
Yeah.
It's kind of confusing sometimes.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure it out.
You need to go to bed, she'll try it.
What time is it?
She'll try it.
8:29.
Bisma reconheceu âmbar no corpo de.
She could be.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that, like, Bhishma refuses to fight with Shikhandi because he is she. Actually, it's not a woman, it's a man. And to say, well, no, it's really Amba, but it's just, even in the past life, she was Amba just because her, I mean, it's a soul that had a feminine body. So it's almost like, no, her soul is, like, she's really her feminine body. And, you know what I mean? It's not clear. It's like everyone has been a man and a woman. So on those grounds, you can refuse to fight with anyone because every man at some point was a woman. So then how can you fight with anyone? And in the battle, at Kurukshetra, the simple fact is that Shikhandi was a man. If Bhishma refused to fight with Shikhandi, I think it's just because he felt guilty about having ruined her life.